This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Which state offers reliably fascinating politics, major national policy issues, and plenty of twists on the campaign trail? The late Tim Russert said it best, Florida, Florida, Florida. This year's race for governor heated up almost as soon as the primaries ended, with the incumbent Republican Rick Scott stepping aside to run for the U.S. Senate. GOP State Representative Ron DeSantis faces Tallahassee's Democratic Mayor Andrew Gillum. Both men debated last night in Tampa, where they took on controversies that have come up in this campaign, including accusations of racial rhetoric from Mr. DeSantis. We've invited both candidates to join us on 1A. Thus far, Mr. DeSantis has yet to respond, but that invitation definitely remains open. Joining us now from WUSF Public Radio in Tampa is Mayor Andrew Gillum. Mr. Mayor, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mr. Mayor, you're in the home stretch of this race, just a few more weeks to go. How's the campaign trail going so far?
It's going well. We are here in the final 15 days of this race, feeling amazing energy out here on the trail. We feel the wind at our backs, are proud of our performance last night at the debate, and frankly, are looking forward to over the next 15 days making the closing case to Floridians as to why I ought to be the next governor to lead this state forward.
Yeah, I wonder where you see that closing case right now. I mean, we're in a very polarized political environment, but we are also a nation with lots of moderates and independents. Florida has plenty of them, as you know. That's kind of why we're a perennial swing state, and I'm speaking as a native Floridian. I wonder what you think has those voters who haven't quite decided between you or Ron DeSantis on the fence. Where do you think that you still need to close the case in the next few weeks?
Well, one, I mean, I think I still have to work to expose Mr. DeSantis' record to the people of the state of Florida, particularly on the issue of health care. While a member of Congress, he voted over a dozen times to repeal Obamacare, going so far as to see the government shut down in order to see his radical extreme policies at the far right of the governing party. 6 years in Congress, never saw a piece of legislation passed under his signature. He also voted while there to see insurance companies be able to discriminate against people based off of pre-existing conditions. There are a lot of areas where we disagree, but certainly on that, I consider him unqualified for the office when you consider that one in five people in the state of Florida don't have access to insurance, and that we've got probably every one of your listeners are sitting next to or have someone in their household who has a pre-existing condition. The fact that you would be in favor of allowing insurance companies to charge more or to deny coverage, in my opinion, again, is disqualifying for the office. So I want to make sure that people understand who Mr. DeSantis is. And the reason he has yet to produce a health care plan for the state of Florida is because Floridians would be terrified to learn if he were to speak honestly with them about what his plans are, quite frankly, to increase costs, jack costs, and reduce coverage.
I wonder how you view the perspective of Florida voters, considering that the outgoing governor of Florida, Rick Scott, was a healthcare executive, and he's pretty well aligned with President Trump on many things and was a two-term governor of the state of Florida. Do you get the sense that Floridians are really tracking with you as it relates to healthcare, or maybe is there a little more diversity in the political views?
I do believe that Floridians are with us. Floridians wanted Medicaid expanded. Our governor was for it, and then he was against it. The Republican-led Senate passed it 39-1 out of the Senate, and then the House obstructed and pushed the governor to the far ends again of his own party. And today, over 800,000 people who would otherwise have access to health care do not. It is a singularly number one priority for me that when we win this race for governor, we're going to get to work to expand Medicaid, because not only is it good for those who don't have insurance, it's good for those with insurance. Many of us are paying premium increases year over year without projection because many of these folks who are uninsured are getting access to health care through emergency rooms, which is the most expensive and least efficient form of care. When we expand Medicaid, we will be able to pull down from the federal government $6 billion that are right now being distributed to other states because of Florida's failure, refusal to expand access. We're going to expand access, lower cost, and put this state on a trajectory where we help to make health care a right and not a privilege.
I do want to reiterate again, we did invite Mr. DeSantis to take part in either today's discussion or a future date, that invitation remains open. But we are, for today, going to focus on our questions for Mayor Gillum. Before I start getting to audience questions, one quick kind of two-part question. Give me a sense of where you, if you win the governor's race, if you hit the governor's mansion, give me a sense of one area in which you think Florida is on the right track right now that you want to continue, and one sense of where you feel like Florida is most on the wrong track that you want to change right away. Where is Florida going right, and where is Florida going wrong?
Well, I tell you, if I could offer a compliment, it would be to the fact that in the, at least in the Florida Senate, there appears to be some bipartisan support and movement when it comes to criminal justice reform. In my state right now, 60% of people who are sitting in jails are there not because they've been found guilty of a crime, but because they could not afford to pay the money bail system. That costs the state of Florida upwards of $770 million a year to deal with that 60% of unconvicted persons. We've got to address the criminal justice system in this state. And I believe it's a place where we can combine with Right on Crime, which is led by Republicans who believe that we're wasting money and can do better by the system. And I also think that there is a majority of Democrats who want to see something done in this space. That is one area where I think we may be able to work with Republicans in leadership in the House. And if the Republicans maintain control of the Senate, where we might be able to find some commonality, some synergy to reform the system and save Floridians money in the process. On the wrong track, I think we're on the wrong track around health care. I think we're on the wrong track around our environment. We've got blue-green algae flowing out of the east and the west side of the state because of the environmental degradation at the hands of Republicans who have led this state for the last 20 years. We're on the wrong track when it comes to our public education system. We're ranked 40th out of 50th in quality, and the average salary for teachers in the state of Florida is the 45th lowest out of all 50 states. So there's a lot of work that we've got to get done, considering that we've been out of power for the last 20 years.
We've gotten a number of questions about climate, and of course the red and blue-green algae blooms are not a new thing for the state of Florida. They've gotten increasingly thick, and they are doing increasing amounts of environmental damage to Florida's coastline on the Atlantic and the Gulf sides. And we got a number of comments and questions about that. Victoria tweeted, "Mayor Gillum, what is your plan for dealing with climate change in Florida in actual real steps?" And Barbie asks, "As a Florida resident, what will you do to help save our beaches and Everglades from climate change and pollution from the sugar industry?"
Mayor Well, Gillum? First they ought to know that when they elect me governor, they will have a governor who actually believes in science. Our current governor and Mr. DeSantis, who has been less than forthright about his positions on the environment, only saying he's not convinced that global warming and climate change is real and that humans are having an impact on it. Well, I believe the science on this. I believe that humans and that we are impacting and accelerating the warming of the earth. And so, one, we'll believe in science, and we're going to assemble some of the best experts that we can to help us to develop a resiliency plan for the state of Florida. We sit at the epicenter of the impact of global warming, climate change, and sea level rise. We now have saltwater tables that are rising above our natural bodies, our aquifers, and our natural bodies of water. We have also, over the last 20 years, essentially handed over the role of the Environmental Protection Agency to the biggest polluters in this state. We've relaxed rules, relaxed regulation. We've relaxed comprehensive growth management planning in the state of Florida. As a municipal elected, as a city councilman for 11 years and now a mayor, I understand what it means to have smart growth policies. And the truth is that what's the pollution that is impacting our water bodies, particularly Lake Okeechobee, is not singular. Mm-hmm. Agricultural is playing a role, including sugar, but also big development is playing a role. We are adding incredible amounts of impervious surface north of the lake. That impervious surface has runoff. It's increasing the level of nitrates in our in our natural water bodies in Lake O. When those discharges happen, it is now spewing toxic water into our estuaries and eventually colliding with our oceans and creating the toxic blue-green algae that we see today. Right. We've got to start regulating that, holding big polluters accountable, developing a more comprehensive statewide approach to growth management and growth development, and then building a 21st century transportation system in this state mm-hmm. where we're taking more cars off the road and using smarter ways to transport people around and throughout the state and throughout our communities to reduce the amount of nitrates and obviously carbon going into our atmosphere.
We're close to a break, but I want to at least begin answering this particular question. James tweeted, addressing housing affordability is key to our economic future. What's your plan? We're coming up against a break, but let me at least let you begin to answer that.
Well, let me say, it'll be quick. First of all, I will veto any budget that raises the Sadowski funds, which is intended to fund affordable housing in our state. And I will work with local governments to develop the kind of local ordinances that might help incentivize developers to build affordable and workforce housing in our state. It's a crisis all over Florida.
I'm sorry, Mayor Gillum. Did you say you would veto any budget that raises Sadowski?
Rated. So for the last probably 8 years consistently, we have taken away Sadowski funds, which are intended to pay for and incentivize the development of affordable housing in this state.
Right.
We've taken that money and put it in the general fund to pay for tax cuts.
Gotcha.
That money needs to go toward its intended purpose, which is to expand the affordable housing and workforce housing inventory in the state.
Plenty more questions to get to with Mayor Andrew Gillum of Tallahassee running as a Democrat for Florida governor, including a question from Leslie. Leslie wants to know, does Mayor Gillum believe he can bring more politicians to the middle? We'll see if we can get an answer to that in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Hinge. Hinge is the dating app that's great at one thing, setting you up on great dates. And they're not just saying that. On Hinge, 3 out of 4 first dates lead to second dates. They are the number one mobile-first dating app mentioned in the New York Times wedding section. So if you're looking for a BFF, a job, a pen pal, or a hookup, Hinge isn't the place for you. Hinge is exclusively designed to get you out on great dates. Download Hinge in the Apple Store or Google Play.
Olympic gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar abused hundreds of women and girls for more than 20 years before he was caught. Hear how a team of women brought down a serial sexual predator. Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking to Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, the Democrat running for governor in Florida this year. Larry tweeted, I hope that when he wins, Mayor Gillum will remember the poorest counties in my former home of the Northwest Florida Panhandle. They may be the reddest parts of Florida, but represent a real opportunity for a Democratic Party reaching out to the working class citizens of our state.
Larry, that is such an important point. And I have to tell you, having just helped to lead my community through the impacts of Hurricane Michael, we had 90% of our power knocked out, thousands of trees come down, roads that were blocked. Within a week, we had 99.5% of people with their power restored, roads cleared, and a sense of normalcy returned to my community. And the first thing we did was dispatch our utility workers to the Western Panhandle, just west of us, to begin that recovery effort for our neighbors. The Gulf Coast region will return, and we will return stronger than ever. But the next governor will help to preside over that restoration. When we are hit with natural disasters, we come together as Floridians. Whether or not politically that is a community that will be for me is of no consequence. They're Floridians, and they're a part of our state that has often been forgotten. Well, the Forgotten Coast will not be forgotten under a Governor Gillum. Not only are we going to see that community restored, we're also going to work with them to help to define an economic future for that region that, again, makes them the pride of the state of Florida.
Before we add one more voice to our conversation, let me follow up with you on that a little bit. One of the conversations that constantly comes up, whether it was after Hurricane Harvey last year, after Hurricane Michael this year, Hurricane Florence earlier, is about the future of these coastal communities. You know, parts of Florida, like Mexico Beach and basically the whole Florida coastline all the way around the state are in areas that are very much at risk for rising water levels, Gulf levels, ocean levels as climate change progresses. And it becomes an increasingly difficult matter as to whether or not people are allowed to live right next to the shore. I mean, you saw the satellite or the drone pictures of homes that were built up to the 2001 building code and homes that weren't. The homes that were standing and the homes that weren't were toothpicks, basically.
That's right.
As governor, That's got to be a tough decision, kind of considering whether or not the state of Florida at a certain point has to tell people, we know you love the ocean, we know you love the Gulf, but it is not safe to live here.
Yeah, no, it's such a fair point. And in fact, speaking about building codes, we may have to revisit our building codes again in light of the fact that we are seeing stronger and more increased storms, particularly up the Gulf where the Gulf waters are so warm.
If you tell people where they can't live, that affects the property tax base, that affects the economy. I mean,
well, listen, right now we have the insurer of last resort in this state having to cover homes that are nice and luxurious and, yes, you know, oceanfront properties, but private insurance companies are refusing to write policies there. And so that puts the entire state at risk for having to insure homes that are being built in areas that are increasingly becoming threatened by rising sea levels. So what I would say is that we are deserving of a real statewide conversation, likely county by county, around how it is that we are going to be building more resilient communities, that in the face of sea level rise and climate change, that it doesn't make sense in some of these areas that we allow for properties to be built and to be built in, and frankly, in an unresilient way, when we know that they are going to be susceptible to being wiped out with these increased storm events and with sea level rise. I can't tell you that there's a panacea. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you in this moment what exact part of the state we would be having to begin this conversation. I think is going to be a statewide conversation, mm-hmm. and it's one that we're going to have to lean into with county and local governments.
I want to reiterate, by the way, we did invite the Republican candidate for Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, to take part in this discussion or a future discussion. We have not yet heard back from his campaign, but that invitation stands. We would certainly love to have him on the program. Let's add one more voice to the discussion now, to the questioning now. Joining us from WLRN Public Radio in Miami is Luis Hernandez, who's the host of its daily talk show, Sundial. Luis, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And Mayor, again, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I do want to note that 31 of 67 counties in Florida have started early voting, and the counties, most of the counties here in the WLRN listening area, including Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties, have begun early voting. Mr. Mayor, it looks as though Republicans are going to hold the Florida House and Senate. So how do you plan to get any of your ideas through if the opposing party is in control of the two chambers?
Well, one, Luis, good to hear your voice again. Two, I'm well aware and thankful for your reminder of the early voting. We actually had some of our supporters who overnighted last night watching the debate and were the first in line to vote down in Miami for early voting. But to your question, one, I am not drawing the conclusion that Republicans will hold the Senate. I think they will likely be in position to hold the House, but I think Democrats will get some gains. That being said, we will have a divided government. I would say this. I think what we've got to look to are where are the areas where we might be able to find some cooperation. I mentioned earlier that I thought criminal justice reform was one area where we might be able to bring Democrats and Republicans together to help get a salve, a solution that might lead to saving money and modernizing a system that is in desperate need of update. And I will tell you, I'm willing and prepared to work with what might be a speaker, Oliva. He and I spent some time together for 2 years making our way through an Aspen Institute fellowship where we got to know each other pretty well. Now, I don't take that to mean that I'm going to convince him to believe in everything I believe or vice versa. But I definitely think that we began from a place where we don't think of each other as, you know, arch enemies, if you will. We're sent there to do the bidding, to do the job of the people of the state. And it's my hope to find areas where we can work together, maybe on affordable housing. Maybe on dealing with health care in some ways. Can I convince them that it makes sense to pull down that $6 billion for health care, which is, for the state of Florida, one of the most exploding parts of our budget? So I'm not beyond working with the other party. I also don't draw the conclusion that you have to be of the same party in order to work together. You'll probably recall that there were a number of sessions where Governor Rick Scott couldn't get his budget through, and he shared the same party with the Speaker of the House and with the Senate president. So there may be some benefit, in my opinion, to negotiating and to them negotiating with me and trying to find solutions. I know Floridians are tired of us getting nothing done. They want their government to work for them, and they're not interested in our partisan, you know, squabbles. They want to make sure that we can produce.
And you mentioned a couple of different things there. One I wanted to approach you on is the criminal justice issue. You've been public about the fact that your family had run-ins with the law in both Miami-Dade County and when you went to Gainesville. Yeah. One of your brothers was arrested on drug trafficking charges. You've made criminal justice reform one of the critical points of your campaign for governor.
Yeah.
How did your family's experience with the law at a young age inform these proposals for updating the state's criminal justice system?
Yeah. I mean, so first, I mean, it shaped it a lot. I think if you recall from my opening video when I introduced myself, I talked a bit about, you know, watching my mother, you know, tears well up in her face when, you know, the cop would come by the house and say, you know, your son's in trouble again, right? That's a difficult thing for any child to have to see and experience. And I remember deciding at a very early age that I never wanted to see that expression on my mom's face because of something that I did. And so I am the first of my seven siblings to graduate from high school and as the fifth of seven kids and the first to graduate from college. When my brother got home after doing his time, I watched him want to be a better father for his daughter and a better partner to his girlfriend and then to his wife. And he went and applied for job after job after job and got told no after no after no. And it really did shape my belief that, listen, how can we say we want people to pull themselves up by the bootstrap, to redeem themselves, to reintroduce themselves into society when we then create all of these barriers that keep them from being able to do just that? And so, you know, as a mayor, I led the effort to ban the box in my city. We don't ask about criminal background history unless answering yes is a disqualifier for the position. If it's not, we're going to measure people off their merit. Are you skilled? Are you qualified? Can you do the work? And what we've learned is that these individuals happen to be some of the hardest working people we have within our government because they know what it means to be without. And if we're serious about trying to reintroduce people into society, then we've got to think about what are those ways that we can give people dignity that comes with work again. Because once they've had access to a job where they can earn an honest wage and honest living mm-hmm. and to be a good example for our communities, it helps us at our crime rate level because the best way to control crime is to reduce the amount of people reoffending. Mm-hmm. It's important and it's played a big role in my thinking around criminal justice reform writ large.
Mayor Gillum, one of the key ways that some are proposing to reintegrate folks back into society has to do with the ballot initiative coming up next month. It would give formerly incarcerated people their voting rights back in the state of Florida. Now, former Attorney General Eric Holder has spoken out about this issue before. Here's part of what he has said.
In many states, felony disenfranchisement laws are still on the books. And the current scope of these policies is not only too significant to ignore, it is also too unjust to tolerate. Across this country today, an estimated 5.8 million Americans, 5.8 million of our fellow citizens, are prohibited from voting because of current or previous felony convictions. Now, that's more than the individual populations of 31 United States, 31 of our states.
That's former Attorney General Eric Holder. Now, I understand that there's tremendous support for this item among some voters. Other voters, Mayor Gillum, are a little hesitant, kind of wondering whether there needs to be another step before ex-felons are able to vote again, whether there are certain circumstances under which felons should still lose their voting rights for life. How do you view it?
Well, you know, this constitutional amendment, Amendment 4, already makes certain carve-outs for individuals, sexual violence offenders and others who have, you know, committed certain crimes where there is still a process for them to have their rights restored. But in the state of Florida, we've got 1.6, 1.7 million people who have had their right to vote permanently taken away from them. Florida is only one of, what, four states that still have this throwback policy on the books. When it passes, and God knows I hope it does, we will immediately re-enfranchise almost a million people in this state. But that's just the first step. I do believe that they ought to have their rights restored. But we're then going to also have to look to, How do we make sure that these folks have the ability to work? How do we ensure that we integrate them into society where they are able to meet, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, right, water, shelter, security? Because if they can't, many of them will make a U-turn. And I think what we want to do is prevent that U-turn by making sure that people have access to, again, jobs and skills and are able to become contributing members to society again.
Before we get to Luis with the next question, we're getting a number of questions from, well, first of all, let me get to a comment from Jillian, who tweeted, I am a registered Republican voting for Mayor Gillum in the hopes of drawing people away from party extremes and into a practice of functioning democratically for the good of the people. We got a number of folks who asked this question. Michael emailed, would you ask your guest if there is any truth to the reports that he intends to implement a state tax? Mayor Gillum, Florida has no state income tax. Is that something, yes, you would change?
Oh, God. Now, I'm so thankful for that question, by the way. My opponent has taken, his campaign has taken to sending text messages to voters suggesting that I will implement a state income tax. So let me be very clear here. One, I am not in favor of a state income tax, and a state income tax in the state of Florida is prohibited by Florida Constitution. A governor actually could not implement a state income tax here in the state of Florida.
You'd have to put it on the ballot, basically.
Well,
you'd have to amend,
correct,
the Constitution, yeah.
Right, but I could not, as the governor, unilaterally implement a state income tax, and I'm not proposing to do so. What we have proposed, by the way, in the state of Florida, the corporate income tax, which does exist here, only 3% of companies in the state of Florida pay the corporate income tax. 97% of companies in the state of Florida pay no corporate income tax at all. LLCs and S-Corps don't pay the corporate tax rate. And I'm not proposing to change that either. What we're proposing is for the 3% of the wealthiest companies in the state of Florida, 3%, the ones that pay the corporate tax rate, that they will pay $1 billion more in corporate taxes. And where does that billion come from? Right now, under the tax realignment under the Trump administration, that same 3% walked away with $6.3 billion of our money. When they reduced the tax burden from 35% down to 20%, that equated to $6.3 billion for that 3%. What we are simply saying is they can keep $5.3 billion of that money ongoing and increasing into, you know, whatever, so long as those taxes, which were made permanent, mm-hmm, exist for them. But we want $1 billion of that to come into the state of Florida so that we can pay teachers a salary they can live on, and that we can reintroduce into our public education system the kind of apprenticeships that used to exist in Florida. Woodwork, okay, shop, mechanical, electrical, technical, right, all of those kinds of programs that allowed our kids to get a skill that they could monetize, go to work, get a job, and earn a good wage. It's a win-win because we are training their next generation workforce.
Let me get to one comment about that very briefly, and then Luis, I know we got time for about one more question from you. With regards to what you were just referring to, Wanda emailed for you to explain what she wrote as the $1 billion tax increase proposed by him and cited in his opponent's commercials. Wanda writes, I'm a Republican who is leaning to voting Democratic in the midterms, but a $1 billion tax increase gives me pause. So that's what the mayor just explained.
And again, that's what I want folks to be clear on. This is our money, right? These were public dollars that used to go into the federal system, mm-hmm, obviously, which also winds its way down into the states, that were given away to the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest 1%. And guess what? Look, you know what? Elections have consequences. That it passed. The president pushed it. It made its way through Congress. But here in the state of Florida, we have a crisis. The state of Florida is ranked, its public education system is ranked 40th out of 50th in quality.
Right.
The increase per pupil spending in my state was 43 cents last year. 43 cents. Our teachers in the state of Florida are paid the 45th lowest average salary of all 50 states. Now, listen, I don't want to pay any more than anybody else, and we won't under any of my tax proposals, including for those corporations. They will pay less under a Governor Gillum than they pay under a Governor Scott. But if we're trying to be a leading state, then we can't have companies saying, I can't come to the state of Florida because I can't get the talent that I need in that state to fill the jobs that we're creating. We're the third largest state in America. It should not be our challenge that we can't produce the talent that we need for the workforce that we've got to build.
Hey, Mayor
Gillum. We've got to pay for it.
Mayor Gillum, I know I promised Luis Hernandez one more question. Can you stay around for like 2 minutes after the break and answer a few more questions? Would that be all right? Good. Thank you. We'll get to Luis Hernandez's next question. Luis Hernandez from WLRN in Miami, as we continue with more of your questions for Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum running for Florida governor. Stay close.
This episode is sponsored by CuriosityStream. If you love documentaries, then CuriosityStream will be your new happy place. From the founder of the Discovery Channel, finally a streaming service for nerds, where you can binge-watch shows on science, history, nature, and more. With over 2,000 films and series and apps on most devices, there's truly something for everyone. Try it for 30 days free at curiositystream.com/NPR and enter promo code NPR.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Louis, I know our time is short, but let me let you get in another question for the mayor.
Yeah, definitely. Mayor, I did want to ask you about the issue of race, because it's been pervasive throughout this campaign. But you already know this. Florida is one of the most diverse populations in the country. The latest census data says that 16% of the population is black, 25% Hispanic or Latino. How's your campaign connecting with black and brown voters to get them galvanized to take part in this midterm election?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are doing all the right things to try to communicate across, frankly, all communities. I've been in red areas, blue areas, purple areas. I was in Putnam. I think Trump won Putnam 30 points. Flagler, about the same much. We've been to the villages. But we are here, you know, I'll be at the University of South Florida, where I am today, with students. Just did a roundtable with a Puerto Rican leadership in Orlando. I hosted an event, Boricuas for Gillum, a little while ago, and was in Little Haiti and did a video because I couldn't make it down there for sort of baby carnival, which went really well. So we're communicating across constituencies. And just to give you an example of, I think, how it is impacting us, is that in the primary election, we saw 150,000 voters turn out to vote who either, one, were voting for the first time, or two, had not voted in the previous three elections, 150,000. The last two races for governor, Democrats lost by less than 70,000 votes. It's my plan to double that number in this general election of unlikely voters. And many of those voters will be younger, voters of color, more women, more poor voters. And I think we're going to perform very, very well. But the reason why I've been going to diverse parts of our state is because we've got to stop treating the race for governor as if it's the Electoral College. You don't win one area and lose another, win one county and lose another. The one who wins is the one who gets one more vote. And that one vote may come through from anywhere throughout the length and the breadth of this state. So I'm prepared to go there. We're going to win because we're going to give voters a reason to turn out and vote for something and not just against.
There are so many things I would love to ask you, Mayor Gillum, so many great policy questions we've gotten from our listeners. Perhaps we'll have a chance to talk to you again. But one more matter of policy I'd like to ask you about before we let you go, and that has to do with gun policy in the state of Florida. Let me amalgamate two questions from two of our listeners by email. Jim emailed, Mayor Gillum, given that at least the House will be in Republican hands, what can be done to reduce the impact of Florida's Stand Your Ground law? It seems unlikely you would be able to repeal it. And then Ryan emailed, what do you plan to do to better enforce current gun control laws before trying to pass new legislation? Mayor Gillum?
Yeah, well, first, I think we have to work hard at the repeal of Stand Your Ground. It is an unnecessary law. In the state of Florida, we already have Castle Doctrine, which allows for individuals to protect themselves and their businesses against intruders onto their property, right?
I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, I hate to interrupt. I think we should probably be clear the difference between what you're talking about, just by way of context. The Castle Doctrine you're referring to basically is that kind of your home is your castle idea that says you have the right to use deadly force
That's
to defend yourself at home or at work.
Yes.
Stand Your Ground carries that farther and says you have the right to use deadly force
in the
if you feel threatened anywhere you have a legal right to be. Just to be
anywhere.
Clear.
Yeah. Right. And again, that's vigilanteism. That's the Wild Wild West in the city streets. You're able to make a decision about whether or not you consider somebody to be a threat, either out of your own imagination or in the recesses of your own mind. And I think that that is dangerous. Castle Doctrine already protects you in your home. There's already common law self-defense, which means in places where you are in public square and you result to having to defend yourself with deadly force, there's already case law on the books where you've been able and you've seen cases where people are able to successfully argue the case that it made sense to be able to use deadly force. But to now take that to a different extreme and to provide under the cover and the color of the law, people being able to snuff out innocent life based off of their perception of threat, to me is a stretch too far. As it relates to what we can do, obviously, on that, I want to make the case, and I want to use regular voices of Floridians to make the case to our lawmakers around the absence of common sense when it comes to these kinds of laws, and to help them understand how families like mine and like others who are raising black children and black and brown children feel particularly under siege by laws like these. Take the case of Trayvon Martin, the case of Marquise McLaughlin, and there are many others. And quite frankly, talk to prosecutors who are saying and are seeing criminals on both sides who are using stand your ground as a way to take out their, you know, their gang enemies because they both have weapons. So it has also been extended to giving cover for legitimate illegal practices in our communities, and prosecutors are left to do nothing about it because folks are able to stand your ground as a self-defense.
And to Ryan's point, before we let you go, with regards to enforcing current gun laws before trying to pass new ones, what would you say to Ryan?
So I would say, one, yes, we must enforce current laws, but we also got to do things like ensure that if you want to carry the power of God at your waist belt, you ought to have a background check. To do things like convicted domestic violence abusers should not get access to weapons where they can snuff out the lives of their loved ones. Closing the gun show loophole. These aren't extreme. These aren't radical. I was sued by the NRA in Tallahassee because we refused to repeal an ordinance in our city which simply said you can't shoot guns in city parks. You can't shoot guns in parks where our kids play and our families picnic. That was considered to be too extreme. We've lost the commonsensical balance here. We're not talking about an affront to the Second Amendment. We're simply talking about how do we keep our kids safe in school? How do we reduce the level of ongoing everyday gun violence that pervades our neighborhoods? Mm-hmm. We got to restore some decency here. And unfortunately, the NRA runs roughshod over the state of Florida right now. We got to put some decency back into it.
Andrew Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee, Florida, running for governor as a Democrat. Mayor Gillum, we really appreciate you making some extra time for us, so thanks
Indeed.
Very much.
Thank you for the opportunity. Good luck, everybody, and go vote to Floridians.
And Luis Hernandez, the host of Sundial on WLRN Public Radio in Miami. You can find more of the station's excellent coverage, including a guide to all the referenda in Florida on next month's ballot at WLRN.org. Luis, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, thanks you, Joshua. Thank you.
Let's zoom out from Florida and look more nationally now at what's going on in other gubernatorial races around the country. Which one should we be paying close attention to? And with all eyes, it seems, on Washington these days, how local are these elections really? Joining us in studio to discuss it is Daniel Strauss, who covers politics for Politico. Daniel, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Thoughts on Florida's governor's race? It sounds like, in some ways, the Florida gubernatorial race is a microcosm of politics in America right now, in addition to all the other issues that are kind of bespoke to Florida, but it kind of seems like Florida is always a microcosm of national politics.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a better gubernatorial race that represents two of the key sort of issues right now. One is President Trump, as embodied by Mayor Gillum's challenger or opponent, Ron DeSantis. DeSantis has been a diehard Trump fan for a lot longer than a lot of Trump's standard bearers in Congress and in elected office. And the other thing, as you guys hit on, is race. This is a topic that is coming up throughout a number of major gubernatorial and Senate races. It is voting rights is a key issue in Georgia right now, and this is something that sort of overshadows the Florida governor's race as well.
Yeah, but something we didn't have time to get into with Mayor Gillum, but there was that comment that Ron DeSantis made basically right after the primary, after Andrew Gillum became the Democratic nominee and he became the Republican nominee, basically expressing his hopes that Florida didn't, in Mr. DeSantis's words, monkey this up by making the wrong decision. That, of course, was widely taken to be a sideways slam at Andrew Gillum, who is black. Does that still feel like it's an issue at the top of the race? Has it kind of blended in with all the other big issues?
It's funny. It's sort of the seed from which grew the sort of the plant or the tree that is dominating this race right now. I don't think that particular comment is the trending a topic of discussion in the Florida governor's race, but it underscores that race relations remains a key issue in Florida.
So, of course, Florida is going to be a big race this year. I may be a bit biased considering that I'm a native Floridian, and it always seems to be a big race. But there are 36 gubernatorial races around the country right now. Are there one or two, maybe other than Florida, that stand out to you as the most worth watching, kind of no matter where you are in the country?
Georgia would be one. Stacey Abrams versus the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. Ohio, where the former chief of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Richard Cordray, is running against Attorney General Mike DeWine. California, where Democrats have one of their most exciting politicians on the verge of winning the governor's race there.
You're talking about Gavin Newsom.
Then actually, basically, overnight, Alaska, which was until recently a three-way race between the independent governor, Bill Walker, former Senator Mark Begich, and the Republican Dunleavy, who had been leading the race for most of the cycle. But Walker, in a surprise move, dropped out and endorsed Begich. So now it's looking like a competitive race in a very conservative state that could be decided by a single point margin. And this is something that Republicans and Democrats hadn't been expecting for most of the cycle.
There's a lot of talk about how the midterms will affect President Trump's presidency. How do you see the races for governor factoring into that?
Well, it's funny. A lot of people are spending more time looking at the House, which is likely to flip, or the Senate, which I think is likely to stay in Republican hands. But this class of governors is the class of governors that's going to preside over redistricting and redrawing the congressional maps for the next few congressional cycles. So it's a very, very important cycle and very, very important moment for governors. If Democrats pick up somewhere between 6 and 10 seats, that might make it easier for them to draw congressional maps that will help Democrats get more elected. If Republicans are able to staunch the bleeding and really hold Democrats to something like 3 or 4, that will ensure that Republican governors in key states like Florida, like Georgia, like Nevada will be able to draw congressional maps and to the advantage of Republicans who are running for Congress.
It's interesting. I saw a graphic, I think it was from 538, that stated that Republicans hold most of the governor's mansions, but the Democratic governors who are out there govern a larger portion of the American people. So if you just do a head count, more Americans live in states that have Democratic governors, but more of the governors are Republican.
Yeah, and look, the more of the governors that are Republican is the advantage in the end, because it's state legislatures and governor's mansions that decide state policy and draw these congressional maps. So if you want the population is important, but we're in a situation right now where Republicans control Congress, Republicans control the Senate, and they have the majority of governor's mansions. They have basically the three cards you would want to have for elections.
How much do big national issues like the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh factor into governor's races? You heard Mayor Gillum say he's going to try to play this more like a popular vote than an electoral college. I understand the logic of that, although Florida is a very factional state. So there's the Interstate 4 corridor through Central Florida, which is heavily Republican, the southeastern corner of Florida, which is heavily Democratic. Leon County, Tallahassee, where he is heavily Democratic. How much of a difference do these national issues make in states where you have deep red bands and deep blue spots? I mean, does it factor?
I mean, it's funny. Right after, around the time of the Kavanaugh hearings and the accusations of sexual assault, a number of Democratic candidates for governor tried to inject that topic into their races. They didn't have any direct influence like a senator might in Kavanaugh's hearings or appointment, but they tried to make it a trending issue. Generally, though, it is much harder for national issues, unless there is some specific application to a state, for governors to really apply in their races.
Another point, I'm sorry, I hate to cut you short, but another point that several listeners asked about that we didn't have time to ask Mayor Gillum had to do with voter turnout. You mentioned the Georgia governor's race, and there are some issues both in Georgia's race and I believe the race in Kansas with regards to voter turnout, voter suppression. How much is that shaping the potential outcome, particularly with concerns about voter suppression?
It's a sincere fear for some voters. I was in Georgia last month, and every time Stacey Abrams would come to a stop with supporters, they would ask her about voting rights, voting issues, and if there were going to be attempts at voter intimidation or voter fraud.
The Democratic candidate.
The Democratic candidate. Look, I think in these states where Georgia and Kansas, where the Republican nominee for governor is a hardliner on voting rights and has really made his name for himself as a staunch conservative on voting rights, this is something that is a trending topic in the race.
Daniel Strauss covers politics for Politico. Daniel, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Alejandro Martinez and Chris Remington from WLRN for helping us produce today's program. Today's show was also produced by Catherine Fink and Morgan Givens. To learn more about them and the rest of our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.